Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for TWiT specials is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT Special 32, the future of the web. Welcome to the TWiT Special. I'm Abby Laporte, and today we'll be talking with some very important guests, all teen entrepreneurs that work, well, sort of teen, from ages 17 to 21, working in the tech industry. And all of us were invited to speak at a conference, and the conference was going to happen yesterday. It didn't end up happening. There were some complications with communication, et cetera, et cetera. But we all have presentations about anything from entrepreneurship and marketing to what the internet futures, the future of the internet will be. So we all wanted a chance to present them. We thought this would be a great opportunity. Each presentation will be around 10 minutes long. Some of us have slides. Others, like myself, are relatively low tech, just a speech, essentially. So each presenter will introduce themselves, give a brief bio, and then go right into their presentation. So first we have Daniel Brugovsky. Is that how you pronounce it? That's so wrong.
Brusilovsky.
Brusilovsky.
It's a thought that counts. So, hi everyone. Thanks for having us. I'm Daniel Brusilovsky, and I founded a site called Teens in Tech about 2.5 years ago, and throughout the process, I've worked for companies like TechCrunch and 8Bits, which got acquired by Twitter, and a company called Quick and stuff like that, which you actually use quite a bit, I've noticed on your YouTube channel. Yeah. So let's go ahead and go to the slides. So I'm going to be talking about the past, present, and future generation of teen entrepreneurs. I think the best way to start with that is to talk, you know, what is entrepreneurship? And quite simply, it's the act of being an entrepreneur, which is a French word, meaning one who undertakes innovations, finance, and business acumen in an effort to transform innovations into economic goods. So, you know, this could be anywhere from starting a new company to be part of a new company and stuff like that. So some background, I'm actually 17 years old. I started a company called Teens in Tech about 2.5 years ago. Now we're a conference business as well as blogs and stuff like that. And I also work at a company called Quick, which does live mobile video. And quite simply, I love what I do. I wouldn't really be here today if I didn't have a huge passion for technology in this industry. So for me, there are kind of three ingredients to being a successful entrepreneur. It's, you know, passion, determination, and drive. And each one of those can mean all different things. But to me, you know, being passionate is, you know, if it takes working 24/7 on your product, that's what it takes. And the same goes for determination and drive. You have to be completely focused on what you're doing and, you know, to what you want to succeed in. So a little bit of background, because this is past, present, and future. The past, you know, Web 1.0, that was from 91 to 2003, and that's known for having, you know, animated GIFs and online guest books and HTML forms sent via email and stuff like that, static web pages. So it wasn't really, you know, super interesting, but it was the start. Now we're in a place where it's Web 2.0, where there's, you know, social software, audio, IM, podcasting, and stuff like that. And that's, you know, that's been from 2003 to present. And that's really all about participation. It's all about talking to other people on the web and stuff like that. And as you can tell, there's tons of startups. I mean, just go to San Francisco and every single block you'll find a company. So this all ties in because we are the future and we're building the next generation of, you know, social platforms and social technologies. I mean, Joey, who I'm sitting next to right here, he has built one of the simplest commenting systems that, you know, a couple of blogs use, which is really interesting. And you'll be talking about that in a little bit. But, you know, we are building the future of technology and of the future generations of platforms. And so how does this tie into teen entrepreneurship? I just mentioned we're building the next generation. So I wanted to talk about a couple of teen startups that were, you know, that have been founded by teen entrepreneurs, just to give people kind of a little backstory. And, you know, it's people are noticing what's going on. I mean, TechCrunch and other blogs have covered sites that, you know, have been started by teen entrepreneurs. And according to entrepreneur.com, 6 in every 10 teens actually want to be an entrepreneur, which I thought was a really fascinating number considering, you know, all the different backgrounds that we come from. You know, it's really interesting that 6 in every 10 teens actually want to be an entrepreneur. There's actually a funny story that UPS was founded by two teenagers, which a lot of people would have never guessed. But if you want the actual full backstory, if you go to that URL, j.mp/UPSteens, there's a whole article that talks about how UPS was founded and quick how it was founded. It was sold to a company that was done by two kids driving around bikes, kind of like a courier. So a couple of, you know, entrepreneurs that founded companies. Fred DeLuca founded Subway when he was 17 years old. And Subway now is a multi-billion dollar company, and Fred DeLuca is actually still alive, and he's helping other, you know, companies become really successful. Of course, there's Mark Zuckerberg, who founded Facebook when he was 19 years old, and now he's all the rage these days. Matt Mullenweg, who founded WordPress, which is one of the most popular content management systems, he founded WordPress when he was 19. Christopher Tate, who founded a company called Zoomer, which was a photo sharing site, which competed with Flickr, he started that when he was 17, and now he lives in Tokyo. And I guess, you know, what I'm really trying to say here is we are the future entrepreneur. And during anything, you know, you can't really let anyone stop you. I've, you know, been in tons of situations where my age has been a stopping factor in situations, and that really should not be the case. And so with that, I mean, I really, you know, want to make sure that people understand that age is just a number. We are building the next generation, and no one can really stop us. And no, don't stop fighting.
Yeah. That's great. Thank you, Daniel.
Yeah. Thank
really
you
great.
So much.
Really fascinating, yeah. So what we're going to do briefly, just so people understand, is that we are now going to swap out one by one. We can go. Actually,
we don't.
I guess we don't have to. We have cameras for everybody. So who's going to go next?
I think Joey.
Joey's going to go next. All right. So let me get Joe's presentation up.
I can go on or sit here, or do you want?
Yeah, just stay right there.
Okay.
I think as it turns out, we're fine. I'm going to get your presentation up. You'll see it behind you, and you'll also see it on the screen. There, so
all right. Hi, my name is Joey Permiani, and I just am so honored to be here at Twit Live in Petaluma. And my passion is designing and technology and creativity. And I worked a presentation about designing simplicity. So, to go to the next slide, a little bio about myself. I'm an interaction and visual design intern at Google, and it's an amazing opportunity. I create with some of the smartest people, and we come up with really creative ideas to, you know, improve existing products or come up with new products. And you can find me on Twitter at JP, Facebook, and my website is jprim.com. And I started out freelancing. I've been doing websites for parents and my friend since I was like 8 years old, and I was always really passionate about technology. And I started working with a lot of developers and designers, you know, early on, just trying to find people online that had similar common interests, and, you know, really working up kind of my company and making money through that. And then while I was in college, I was studying computer science, and I came out to Silicon Valley to like try to find the smartest people I can work with. So I worked at Revision 3, which you guys know very well, with former Tech TV personalities working on their UI design on their homepage, as well as Yahoo on SearchMonkey and the Boss projects. And what I really love is search and how people are using search and how it's changing over, you know, it's changing everything. And working at Google, you really learn how to design the most simplest products and the most successful products that half a billion people use around the world. So if you go to the next slide, there's a really famous saying called Occam's Razor. It's actually a fundamental idea of, it was started by William of Ockham, and it was, he applied it to law. He applied it to a lot of other fields. And most likely it does get applied to design. And that means, the simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. Leonardo da Vinci said that. And, you know, what does simplicity mean? It's really hard to create this, you know, something simple that's for you, but also maybe somebody that's in Germany, or, you know, how do you know what is simple? So that's something that as a user experience designer, you have to think about and, you know, make sure that you create the most successful product. And you also learn a lot through quantitative research and qualitative research about how people are using your product and how people are really, what they love about it and when you have to change. Because we live in a web now where, you know, you have to constantly change your product and you have to like learn from what your users are liking. And so we have a lot of success metrics that we, you know, study, and that's what I'm really fascinated with. At Google, we're known for like the omniscient one box, right? Like the servers around the world. You can go next slide. The servers around the world, we have the most complex ones. And, you know, you can basically, Marissa Meyer, she talks a lot about this, about, you know, you could put everything that you're searching for, whether it be photos, text, or images, and get back the most relevant results possible. And that's all done through just a simple text box. The next slide is about Dig. And originally when Dig started out, yay, Dig, they had actually a two-button approach where they were starting to, you know, when you're on the homepage, you want to dig something, you had to click Dig, and then you had to go to another page, Dig. But then a really talented designer, Daniel Burka, he designed an Ajax kind of Dig Me approach. And this was in the very beginning. And I think this is really what made Dig really popular. Just something so simple and something, you know, really, you know, instead of saving two, you know, doing two clicks, you do one click. And it really was one of the things that, you know, made Dig really successful in the beginning. And then the next slide is on my website, joeypermiani.com. I created this. I'm really fascinated with the people, like with people commenting. And so I thought it was really complex, like to ask, you know, for your name, your email, your website, when you post a thing on your blog. And so if you go to the next slide, I came up with an idea to be able to only use your Twitter username and comment, and to be able to pull your Twitter username, your avatar, your full name, your website, your location, your timestamp, and your message just from, you know, your Twitter username. And what I noticed was something dramatically happened when I did that. When I launched my website, people, drastically increased community engagement. And, you know, something like as simple as just only asking for a few fields, people are so busy and they don't want to, you know, always. If we can be a few steps ahead of, you know, knowing what their intentions are and trying to fill it out, then it saves people a lot of time. And so you can actually download this now. It's a WordPress plugin that I created. It's free at joeypermiani.com. It's a WordPress plugin. So, and it's a great way to bring a lot of commenting onto your website. And so when you're building a web application, you have to take a couple of things in mind. You know, people's times are limited. And speed is like the number one feature. You know, when Google first started, you know, it was the fastest. You know, people almost had to see the copyright logo on the bottom to know that the page was done loading, because it was like that clean and that simple. You know, because I remember some of the beginning usability studies, people they said, you know, people just waited and they thought because the page wasn't, you know, loaded. So. And you always want to think of like how you can reduce the number of clicks and the number of screens possible to get to your goal. Like, what are your goals for the website? You know, when you're creating something, you have to, as like a designer, you're kind of, you want to have complete creative control of like your product, right? You want to put a lot of design and thought into it. And when you're building a web application, you have to make sure that some of like the navigation and the fundamental things with design on the website are still adhered to, you know, how people can use the website. And it's really important to make it both like, you know, your own creative flair, but also have it so, you know, people can you know, just be able to see it within the 0.5 seconds of when they see your website to know exactly what it does. And a lot of people do a lot of repetitive behavior, and like, how can you learn from it? And a lot of the design is in the details. And so first and foremost, the speed is the most important feature. And so this kind of leads me up to a project I was working on, a demo of this new company I started called Cortex. It's a project I'm working on right now. You can request an invite at cortexapp.com, and I'll show you the demo of it. So basically, I learned from this behavior and how many, you know, repetitive things people do, and a lot of people... I'm really interested in how people are sharing across the web. So you're sharing a bunch of couple different social pools, a couple of different networks, right? So I'm on a really good website I love called Found. It's F-F-F-O-U-N-D. And so say I like this for my own Tumblr. Basically what I could do right now is click on it, and it brings up this pie menu of where do I want to send it? So I can click on this image and then be able to share it to my Tumblr. So say say I like want to share it right now to my Tumblr.
That's awesome.
And bam, that's all I have to do, right? So now if I go on my Tumblr.
Is that CSS? What are you doing there?
So this is a Chrome JavaScript? Extension. And
it's a Chrome extension.
Okay. HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. So right now, all I have to do is do that. And then when I go on... my Tumblr website, it'll show up here.
So it's a little easier than a bookmarklet.
Yeah, it takes about a second, but it's something, you know, really fast, and I could see people using this all the time. You know, it's like such a thing that people do a lot. So this is one example. We have Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr support right now, and we're going to be launching a couple other projects. So right now, so it's going to post to my Tumblr any second, I think, if I actually go on my Tumblr.
And where do I get an invitation?
You can go to cortexapp.com. Yeah. And then so right now, also, so that it's going to post. But then, so say you find something that you find, you know, really interesting. Right now, I'm on the Twit Live website, so we're going to do like a picture-in-picture kind of thing. But say, like, I want to send this out to Daniel. I specified that I want to send this out to Daniel. And then, so right now, that's all I had to do. And then, so say if I go back to Facebook, and then I go into Daniel's profile, and then see it right here.
Instant.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Isn't that cool?
That's awesome.
So, and then also, say I want to tweet it out. A lot of times I find websites that I really like that I want to share with people. And so I can go and click on here, and then be able to say Twitter. And then, so right now I'm kind of in this like terminal mode where it's like, I live on Twit. I'll just say like live and then press enter. And then, oh, because I think I already tweeted it. But let me try another site. So say I go on just twit.tv. And then, so say I like this website. It automatically does the URL shortener for you. It does the title. So say I say live. And then, so right now, I should see it on my Twitter. Come up. It might take a sec.
This is Twitter, remember. This isn't Google.
Everybody get off the Wi-Fi network. Steve Jobs.
Turn off your Wi-Fi.
Yeah. So let me try it again.
So this is cortexapp.com.
I'm going
to put in my email. That's really cool. How hard is it to write a Chrome extension?
It's not really hard. If you have HTML and CSS and JavaScript kind of experience, then it's fairly straightforward. And it's really fun to, you know, if you're just getting into web design or web development, to start off with a plugin or extension. And so it's available on Chrome. But so if you see, like, it tweeted out. But... that's it. And if you go to cortexapp.com and then request an invite, we'll be sending out invites shortly to use this. And I hope that, you know, people, you know, save a lot of time, and people can, you know, share stuff with their friends and family like really, really fast between these social networks. And so
that's really neat.
Thanks.
Thanks, Joe.
Yeah.
Who's next?
Hi, guys. My name is Mark Bale, and this is 5 tips I wish I had for being a young entrepreneur. So yeah, if you're thinking of being a startup guy, this is what you want to know. So, next slide. So who am I? My name is Mark Bale, and I'm an entrepreneur, and I've been on what seems to be my 12th startup, I think. And now I work on about 6 startups as a founder, and all of them are in completely different markets and concentrations. But I'm also a big-time believer in nonprofits, and I've started 3 early-stage nonprofits. And I just graduated from high school, and yes, I'm going to college at Bentley University in Boston. So one of the most important concepts in entrepreneurship, and it is indeed what starts the company in the first place, is the idea of idea generation. Idea generation is what you'll be using to conceive the initial purpose of the startup. And it doesn't mean, however, you can just go about and using some generators that tell you, you know, oh, thank you. Thanks. Gotcha. Thanks. What's up, Leo?
Get close here, man.
Yeah, it's the closest I've been to you.
Oh,
there
God.
We go. It doesn't mean, however, we're going to be using... It's not like we're going to be using generators that tell you to be like the Subway of sandwiches or the Google of Facebook or, you know, the Apple of Bed Bath & Beyond. It's more like what really means is to getting the idea of the mindset of the entrepreneur. An entrepreneur has a mindset that allows them to identify startup opportunities easily, more easily, than someone who doesn't have this mindset. So... the mindset is based on one simple question that you'll find yourself constantly asking yourself. And that's, how can I improve this? This is a simple question that when you use this in life and you think about it in life, that identifies the bedrock of your startup, the pain point it's fixing, or in other words, the solution to the problem you've identified. Now, your problems, your solutions to these problems are meant to solve... The solutions that to the problems that you solve are meant to improve people's lives. That's the one thing you have to keep in mind. And the solutions that you do make have to be disruptive, implementable, monetizable, and... Oh, sorry. Disruptive, plausible, monetizable, and implementable. And if you have an idea that encompasses all 4 of these, you'll know that you have a good idea and that you can realistically work with. Plausible, that you don't want to build an app that you can't realistically build. Disruptive is good for marketing and how important your product is to the consumer. Implementable is something, it's kind of the same as plausible, but it's implementable in that you can make it and perhaps with some learning, and that's a good thing. And monetizable because, well, let me say this first. Next slide is you want to make something people want. This is something Paul Graham says a lot, and you'll definitely see it attributed to Paul Graham a lot. Or in other words, as Guy Kawasaki says, make meaning in your product. Facebook for almost a decade now has allowed us to connect, you know, our friends and classmates and family so much closer and so much closer and so much better. And Dropbox has allowed teams and friends to share files and information so much faster. You know, Last.fm has allowed people to discover music so much easier, like Netflix for movies. And, you know, Palinera Bread has allowed me to spend less time, you know, meeting girls and more time eating sandwiches. So you're going to have to pick between a business or a nonprofit. Not businesses make profit, nonprofits don't. A lot of startups fall in the category of nonprofit. They stay in free forever. They don't have a plan and make revenue. And as a result, they don't make revenue. And they cease to be in business and start being a nonprofit. And they fail. And you don't want, and not, that doesn't necessarily mean you have to go out and make a 10-page business plan with an early stage company. But you can make one. You can make it less than like 5 pages. But the more important thing is you have to make a revenue plan. A revenue plan makes you think of the ways you can generate revenue and what direction you can take your new business in. So, and still one of the main reasons that people create companies, even though it's one of the main reasons that people create companies, it's something that a lot of startup people don't realize. 37 Signals did a presentation at Startup School. I just Googled Startup School 37 Signals. That was based around the number one way to generate revenue for your product. Actually having a price. Most startup entrepreneurs make a free product and, you know, never move beyond free, even though that generates a lot of traffic and makes people use your service, but that results in the death of a startup. Okay. Number 4, the most important unknown aspect of a startup is marketing. As marketing is something that it's talked a lot by, but not really covered by a lot of startups, in fact, most startups do lose sight of marketing as part of their overall strategy. Some launching first and then not being able to do anything. They don't know how to proceed, how to get customers, and sometimes they try ads and, you know, their CAC is too high, their customer acquisition cost is too high. Marketing is something I found is one of the most important aspects of a startup. Probably even more so sometimes than the product itself, because it is often ignored. learn about marketing. You have to read books like Inbound Marketing by Dharma Shah and For a Good Introduction to Marketing. Then read Sean Ellis's blog, startup-marketing.com, for a more advanced view into marketing for startups, as well as Steve Blank's customer development. Those will get you a good idea of not only of starting a startup, but also marketing a startup as well. And the last thing that you have to focus on is you have to create an unsurpassable experience that other people have to work hard to create. When you're using a product or service, you're going to have to create an experience that people will experience. And the value of this experience is going to be the most important thing for your customers, and will be the basis of evaluation that your customers will use for your startup. And you have to build an amazing service that people will love. Design something that people will talk about. Create something that will affect and disrupt people's lives and change the world. Go out and have fun.
Yeah.
What up?
Thank you, Mark.
All right. Hey, everybody. My name is Brian Wong. I'm glad to be here. Very honored as well. I hail from Canada, from Vancouver. Just a quick shout out to Vancouver and all the people who are watching from there, aka the five people I texted. Thank you very much. And I wanted to today just share some thoughts that I've been sharing all around the world, mainly along the vein of being young and rocking it. And what that means essentially is how to leverage your youthful aspects and rock it in the entrepreneurial way to change the world for the better. All right, so I wanted to just share quick seven things that I've learned, just being an entrepreneur and working for another company and sort of moving through the spaces that I moved through, to just share some of the things that I think are very valuable that could help you, you know, jump off that cliff that is being an entrepreneur and rocking it. And this is obviously very extremely related to how we can apply these skills to the web and how we can leverage it and all the fabric that we're all engaged in and connected to and how we can all win at what we're doing. So just a little bit about me. So I graduated last year from university at the age of 18. So I skipped two grades in elementary and high school. Did not move that too fast, but sort of getting that school out of the way was a lot of fun. And I did a business degree, but I've started designing when I was 11 years old. And last year, I met up with a few very friendly people over at Dig, and they were kind enough to give me an opportunity to work in business development there. And so I had the opportunity to be in business development in technical partnerships and press partnerships up until about a month ago when I left to start my own company. So the Android app actually was my project over at Dig. So if you haven't installed that on your Android phone yet, please go ahead and do so. Awesome. So also last year when I graduated, during that period of time when you don't really know what you're doing, I decided to start something just to leverage off of the free stream of information that was the Twitter API. And so Follow Formation was sort of started around the time when Oprah had joined Twitter. And there were a bunch of moms that I knew were going to be on Twitter and trying to figure out what was going on. Like, who do I follow? And so Follow Formation answered that question. It was an automated user discovery service based on what you were interested in. So feel free to check that out. And here was just a bunch of the press that ended up catapulting us to something that was noticed by a few people that, you know, that they wanted to use. And so I ended up at Dig, of course, and we'll just keep on moving along here. And this is, of course, the new Dig. Very excited about it, and the Android app as well. And now off to, oh, yes, and this is a little bit of a fun thing about how fun it was to work at Dig and also being underage. This is the beer fridge at Dig. Someone put up a sign with my photo that was captured in LA Weekly that apparently I shouldn't be served. That's so awesome. But yeah, so my next company is called Keep. It's a little bit stealthy, but it's in the space of mobile in-game advertising. And so you can check out a little bit. I mean, there's not a lot at the website at keep.me. That's KIIP.me. So what I wanted to start off with is that a lot of entrepreneurs we are on, or aspiring entrepreneurs, we are on a cliff. You know, we have everybody around us giving us every reason why we shouldn't jump. You know, it's too risky. You'll die. It's a fast fall. You know, really bad things that, again, are barriers to helping young entrepreneurs wanting to actually jump. But I'm here to give you every reason to jump. And I'm going to push you off that cliff and help you grow wings while you're falling. And through these seven things that I've learned, All right. So number one is, you are the most powerful force in your life. I know a lot of young entrepreneurs around the world that are waiting for things to happen to them. You are the person who controls your hand. You choose what actions you want to do. A lot of people do not realize that, Leo, next slide, that asking is very, very underrated, that you have the internal locus of control. You can pick up that phone and ask. Find people that matter to you. Find people that are relevant in your space that you want to learn from. And people expect you to take that first step so they know exactly how to help you. If you don't ask for help, no one knows how to help you. So that's why asking is super, super underrated. And I really, really encourage everybody who is young, who knows that there's people who are successful in their space and wants to learn from them, that I know that every successful person that's a little bit older has what I call a good quota. They want to help out people. They want to help someone who was once in their steps and in their phase of their life when they were younger. And so that's the reason why there's always nothing to lose when you want to ask for help. And so what I did with Follow Formation is that we did nothing but pitch, pitch, and pitch. So if you might have, one of the things that really, really catapulted Follow Formation to the next level was the ability to tag onto a bunch of press. Now, people thought that this came to us.
Who are all these FUs in here?
Pardon?
There are a lot of FUs in the,
okay.
All right. The screen. Does that mean they were not interested?
Oh, no, no, no. FU meant following
follow up.
Up. Following
oh, good.
Up. Yeah, yeah, no. Was it? Yeah, yeah. You read the FU. It meant I followed up. Yeah. So, no, it wasn't anything mean. But essentially, we pitched over, 100 journalists, and what I did was I actually woke up at 5 in the morning for about a week because this was, of course, 8 o'clock Eastern time, and a lot of the journalists were over there. And basically, what I wanted to do was to pitch and to be able to tell these people that I knew were able to get the word out there that what we were actually trying to create was genuinely helpful and beneficial. And I knew that because of this tenacity and perseverance that something would come of it, and something did. And so it wasn't easy. We had to actually put the work in. A lot of people feel that it's something that has to come to you and that it's some sort of a, it's sexy to say that something's an overnight success. But at the end of the day, like Malcolm Gladwell and like he mentioned in The Outliers and a bunch of other very prominent entrepreneurs have been quoted saying that it's all about hustling and, hauling ass, essentially. So the next is think big. There's nothing wrong with thinking big when you're young. In fact, this is probably the time in your life where you're allowed to think big. And people know that there are no bounds or you don't know the limits yet. And that type of naivete is actually very beneficial to you right now. And take that advantage and think as big as you can, but at the same time, be as cognizant as you can about your limits. But just realize that thinking big and thinking really, really big is going to help you get really far. So of course, the next slide here is referring to the social network, the movie about the inception of Facebook. And I do agree, you don't get to 500 million friends without making a few enemies. And of course, Mark thought really, really big. And one of the reasons why he didn't sell the company really early on is because I had a feeling that I think he knew what was going to happen. I think he knew that he was going to create this open graph and have this information available for everybody to share. So number three is, you have what it takes, and of course, in the background is the little train that could. And so, let me prove it to you. I think that we normally do not realize the amount of information that's available to us to learn. We always put up mental barriers, things like I don't know enough, or I don't have enough money, or no one wants to work with me on this. You have what it takes. And let me prove it to you. These are all the these are just some of the resources that are available online that are free for everybody to learn. You could be in the middle of nowhere. And of course, like earlier this week, I was actually in Honduras, in Tegucigalpa, doing this exact same talk. And I showed them that even though you're in the corner of a world, you still have available to you all of these vast resources that can help you learn everything that you wanted to know. There are no excuses anymore. Just remember that. So number four is use your youth. When you are young, you have the ability to sleep for 3 hours a day, survive on ramen alone, drink coffee to be able to provide your energy, and still walk out alive. Use that now because you won't be able to use it later. And make sure that this is part of what you want to do to remain positive. Because when you're young, you have this sense of energy and positivity that doesn't fail. And leverage that to the fullest extent. Your lack of understanding of potential obstacles and your ability to be immune to them actually gives you that audacity that can make you go further. And of course, partying is very important. So this is actually a slide that I put up when I was in Central America. Campus Party is in Mexico City, and I encourage them to go out and party, because a lot of the times we feel like we're alone. We feel that there aren't any people who can share the same type of drive, but there are a lot of them, and you can connect with them in these venues, and I highly encourage you to do that. And again, leverage the youth that you have. And I remember very distinctively when I was in university, it was the only time you could go partying and then at 7 a.m. wake up for an interview for a job and still be able to pull it off. The number five is build your brand with your strength. So in the background, of course, is the Influence Project that's been well commented on by Fast Company. But the reason why I mentioned that is that a lot of the people who have been building their brand and have been sort of increasing their influence online have done one thing really well, and that is making their strength, the thing that they know that they do really well, really, really big. So of course, you know, people like Sarah Austin, who she knows that is really good at asking questions. That's all she does. She asks questions really well, and she makes it a big part of her brand. And so I encourage everybody who has those strengths to, you know, you can be what we call a specialist, but a generalist, right? Know what you do really well, do it really well, and build it as part of your brand, but make it huge. Number six is we are borderless. And of course, this was a very important point that I wanted to make when I was down in Tegucigalpa. But we are living in an age where we are, borderless. We are international travels. You know, we can move between platforms like water. You know, we are bound by this fabric of the web, and there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to do everything faster and more efficiently. There's no reason why a kid in Tibet can connect with a kid in Honduras and kick some ass, right? And so having been all over the world, I've seen that with the web, we've been connected by trends that have been defined by something that's agnostic to borders, something that is so unified that we all understand that, you know, when we were talking about what the latest trends were, people were saying, yeah, mobile, location-based services. And I'm like, my gosh, it's the same everywhere, because the web has been defining that for all of us. So here's another relevant local example as well. In Central America and Latin America, they have something called Piola, and it's actually a virtual conference sort of congregation where they have conferences very regularly that are all people tuning in via Ustream. And so anybody can participate, and that's super important to realize what the web has been able to enable us to do. And the last point, and this is for everybody who doesn't feel like they're exactly as young as everybody sitting in this room, is that we are all young. And let me prove it to you. This isn't just me saying something to try to, you know, stroke everybody's egos here. So moving to measuring youth. These are all the measures that marketers use to look at youth. You know, you have things like growth potential, network presence, brand affinity, la 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 la. But I wanted to focus on two things: numerical age and online behavior. Numerical age is just one of the things that define youth. We're all young. We have we're as young as we think we are. And numerical age is just one point of measure. We can be 16 or 80, but at the same time, if we all have similar online behavior, and right now we're starting to see things like Twitter having the largest and fastest, or not largest, but the fastest growing demo being 45 to 55. We're seeing behaviors that are increasing that are very unifying when we're looking at youth in general. And so what I'm trying to say is that based on behavior, based on our sharing, based on what we're doing in these social networks, we are all considered young. And so this is just photographic evidence that we all are. And so I think we are a generation of innovators. And what I wanted to show you is a video that kind of proves this and hopefully will help tip a few people over that cliff.
Thank you.
really nice. Yeah.
All right. So my final message is very, very simple. And that is there the slide there?
Oh, you want to go back to your slides?
Really, right. It is what? A couple more.
Yeah, there we go.
Or maybe the delay will ruin the... Oh, there we go. Now go kick some ass, guys.
That's a good one. Great. Wow. And here's the contact
I believe I can fly now, is one of the chat room comments.
Isn't that awesome? That's great. And we'll also, after this, have a panel discussion. And I think so, we should let the chat room ask questions of the panel discussion. Go ahead.
So, after this, we will be having a panel discussion, and hopefully we can kind of find a way to talk about all of our different ideas together during that panel discussion. And then, of course, I think we probably will end up taking some questions. So, first of all, I do want to preface my speech with a few things, because, in fact, it is a lot more like a speech than the other presentations. I am much more low-tech than most of these guys. I'm not an entrepreneur. I do not have a business. I have not started a business. And actually, I don't intend to start a business unless that means some sort of journalistic endeavor that may be in my future. And instead, I took basically the prompt for these presentations quite literally, and what I intend to talk about is... like Daniel, the past, present, and future of the internet. Now, how I intend to do this is, firstly, I'm not going to be able to accurately predict anything. These are all assumptions. I am going to be talking about some really, some really far-reaching ideas in terms of predicting what will happen with the internet, predicting what could happen with the internet. But, of course, take it at face value. I'm 18. I don't have any idea what I'm talking about. Not very tech savvy. And the second thing is that how I formatted my speech is talking about the internet in terms of human instinct. So talking about how we use the internet to fulfill basic human needs and basic human wants. The reason I've done this is because I feel that reframing how we think about the internet can be a very powerful way to recognize different aspects of the internet, what it can do for us, what the issues are, how it's not working, how it could fail potentially, and how it could succeed. So, first off, we think about human instincts. There hasn't actually been a concrete set that scientists have decided are the human instincts. So the way I'm going to be talking about it is in terms of survival of the individual and survival of the group. So in survival of the individual, we have the basic need for food, need for safety, physical safety. In survival of the group, of course, there is the want to procreate, so sex, and then the want to ensure that the needs of the individuals in a given group are met. So when you care about your friends, when you care about your friends' safety, when you care about your family getting food so that they can stay alive, those kinds of things. So that's basically the four different primary instincts I've divided human instinct into. So now, in the past of the internet, I think it's been pretty clear what kinds of things the internet has developed out of. So initially and in general, it fulfills needs. So for instance, survival of the individual. This can be food, safety, like I was talking about, etc. This is the primary category of needs, it seems. So this can come into play with social networking, with any kind of internet thing involving money. So any website where you can make money, etc. Because as I'm sure we can all tell, money is basically the modern way to ensure you will get food and therefore stay alive. So that fulfills that human instinct. And when we think about it, we think about something like Twitter. Twitter is literally telling you everything that's happening constantly. That is so like the caveman in us trying to stay aware of our surroundings and thus stay safe. In terms of news sites, this is ensuring the individual will find success in their career by staying on top of the news and thus have enough money for sufficient food and to ensure the safest possible life. So when we break it down like that, we can see how a lot of the functions of the internet are ultimately just fulfilling these primal needs as humans, which makes sense, of course, because what else would it be doing? The second one is the drive to procreate. So obviously this comes into play with the blatantly sexual sites on the internet, just really basic. I know there was an article written lately that talked about how a huge part of the development of the internet was because of basically like porn, and that there was a lot of money and a lot of time put into developing that just because people were looking at it and there was advertising and it was profitable. So clearly that comes into play. That's a human instinct. That's a really fundamental way that we as humans have engaged with the internet and created and developed the internet because of our human instincts. You know, online shopping, video sharing, social networking, any other sort of online habit that could make someone, you know, quote unquote, more desirable or have a way to meet anyone, for instance, in social networking. Now, this is kind of the past. This is kind of what has been part of the internet, how it's been working. What I'm going to be talking about is slightly less optimistic than the other kids in the room have been talking about. But what I'm seeing is problems with this, because it seems as though, and keep in mind, this group of people today, we're all really, really engaged with the tech world. But for me, as someone who is slightly less engaged, I'm not, you know, in a startup, I'm not doing all these things. I'm seeing personally, at least within my friends, almost a movement away from the internet and a movement offline. And a lot of the times it's hard to recognize that. A lot of the times we get really caught up in being in an internet culture that we don't think about, say, all the people globally that are offline. You know, anyone who, well, okay, for example, I have an anecdote about it, but, well, I'll just go right into it. Anyway, so the problem I'm seeing, first of all, there's the problem of the amount of data. This is problems I'm seeing that seem to be causing almost a movement away from the internet. So I'm just going to lay them out clearly. I know many of you would disagree that there's not a movement away from the internet, but I'll tell you why I think there is. So right now, the quantity of content is insane. It's shocking. Billions and millions and trillions of articles and videos and things to watch and things to see and people to look at and pictures to look at and everything. It's insane how much is online. So let's see. Sorry, I wrote this in a really interesting format, but we'll see how it goes. So and this is the beauty and the curse of the internet. This ends up being both a really amazing thing because we can find that one article that applies specifically to our life, because there are so many articles. We can find the one person who did a video blog that has the exact same opinion as us and can validate what we already feel like we know, or the perfect video testimonial that changed our global perspective. What we may have not yet discovered, or what we may be in the process of discovering as it becomes more apparent, is the horror of having to sift through these millions upon millions of documents and photos and song clips. Even when using a brilliant search engine, we can't help but allow our human minds to wrestle with just how much we have access to. We have access to so much. Now, this becomes a curse when it pushes us away from what the internet does have to offer. And I want to quote a study. Tell me if I'm going over time. I feel like this is taking forever. Okay. So take, for instance, the variety of studies about how choice affects the human brain. So we tend to freeze up when we're confronted with this variety of choices. For instance, in a supermarket, our brains are not programmed to process 14 different brands of meat. Those 14 cellophaned, perfectly cut pieces are eons away from looking at one rare mammoth with your tribe mate's bloody spear sticking out, right? So as cavemen, we weren't, you know, and I use that term, I'm kind of throwing that around, but when we think about human instinct, we don't really have that kind of capacity. And it's the same concept with information. Our instinctive reaction to a new scenario is to check, firstly, if it's safe, secondly, if there's food, and thirdly, if there's possible mates. So these instincts, yeah, maybe they're repressed nowadays, but they just don't really mesh with the internet and with the choices we have in the internet. And as we jump from site to site to site in a span of literally 3 minutes or less, we're fighting internally with these instincts. I know that at least personally, I have felt, as mentioned before, a bizarre and hidden terror when faced with the prospect of over 10 emails or a few different videos I want to watch, or the fact that I have the power to download any one of 11 million songs at any given moment. That's crazy. So that's the first issue. The second issue, and I'm going to go through these issues, and then I'm going to talk about what we can do to keep people online and to keep people using the internet despite these issues. So there's three more issues I have right now with the internet and the world online. And it seems like other people have the same issues. So the first one, there's the question of mystery. Second is the question of sentimentality. And thirdly, safety, which is quite a hot topic right now. And it has been for years, actually. So let me explain. The question of mystery matters because through various points in history, in various places in the world, allure, exclusivity, and elusive manners have essentially always been associated with both sex appeal and power. So that can lead ultimately to the fulfillment of the human desire for food through money in terms of marketing, or simply, you know, being sexy as an individual. When someone seems difficult to find or to understand, we're very often initially frustrated, but ultimately intrigued, right? I think we've all kind of experienced that. It's interesting. It's fun if you feel like you can connect with someone who's exclusive or elusive. So this curiosity that mystery yields can either lead often to buying something, again, this is in terms of marketing, etc., or being, again, like I mentioned, sexually attracted to the person exuding the mysterious nature. So I'll make it a little bit more simple. Though it is uncomfortable perhaps to hear it called by name, there's a movement in America of youth from ages 15 to 30, predominantly white middle class, upper middle class, left-leaning, consumer conscious, generally ironic, usually fashion and tech savvy people who are at times referred to as hipsters. Now, it is an ever-growing consumer group, ask any Urban Outfitters marketing rep, and a group that seems to be, in general, at least anecdotally, I've seen moving away from the internet. Now, I know that they are known as kind of the first to embrace social networking. Many of them are known as Apple users. At least personally, I have seen. Well, I mean, to be fair,
there's
to be
a
fair,
few in here. Yeah.
What?
Apple users. Oh, yeah. And hipsters.
Well, okay, whatever. But here's the thing. Bear with me. I know it's hard to talk about them. I know it is. But like I said, I've been seeing this shift away from the internet. And I personally have been able to connect this shift away from wanting that mystery back. Because it's like having a Facebook page is just not mysterious. And it's thus not sexy. No one is curious about someone who has their whole life on display. There's simply nothing to be intrigued about because you can see it all right away. It's like the kid in fifth grade who talked about themselves and their life. None of us wanted to know anymore, right? There was nothing more to know, you know? I mean, so with this consumer group and other groups, there's a desire on an individual basis, so as these individual consumers, for allure through mystery. So that can often lead to, and this can be through lack of information, through being difficult to find, etc. So this can lead to a move offline. In the same way, personally, it seems like it's happening in marketing as well. So there's something awesome about having a thing that no one else has, right? So it makes sense for a company to try to capture allure and mystery by being exclusive and hard to find. If there's, say, a silkscreen shirt company that's sold in one boutique in New York City that can't be bought online, it makes sense that it'd be cool to have that shirt. And thus, it can be a benefit money-wise and therefore fulfill that human instinct to be offline, even if only when marketing to a certain crowd from a certain perspective, a crowd obviously that likes exclusivity from a perspective of having already had success. But the point is, the mystery is a very valid reason to move away from the internet. I've tried to illustrate this, as you can see through these two examples, but individuals can be seeking sex appeal through elusive airs, As in, by not being searchable or not being very active on social networking sites, and individuals working for a company may seek more money and thus more food, again, back to human instincts, through mystery or through the consumer appeal of exclusivity. So, and then just briefly, sentimentality is another issue that I brought up. This cultural backtracking is a social is a common social phenomenon. For ages, we've seen it. The naturalist movements in the 1800s, the 1960s, et cetera, the desire to go back to a simpler time when you didn't have to update and check and keep connected is shared by many. I know at least many of my friends have been talking about that. Often it's based simply on aesthetic. That is the old-fashioned beauty of writing a letter or the romanticism of paying someone a visit as opposed to commenting on their wall or asking them something anonymously on their FormSpring. Finally, one of the most popular issues, I know everyone is way sick and familiar of this comment, but is the question of safety in terms of the web and in terms of privacy on the web. So for years, we've been bombarded with story after story about the brutal loss of privacy and often physical harm befalling both the reckless and careful internet users. And of course, an importantly human instinct and need across the board is to feel safe. And if social networking or even personalized ads and so on are making people feel threatened, they're obviously going to move offline. How am I doing on time? Is this going way? Well, no, but okay. No. I'm almost done. I'm almost done. Sorry. Okay. So, well, I just wanted to explain them thoroughly because otherwise, okay. So, but the point is of all this, of me describing these issues that are making people move away from the internet, is I think there are some ways that we can get the internet, get the World Wide Web to continue appealing to young consumers, continue appealing to marketing reps, etc. So I think, now, this is controversial because everyone has been talking about, okay, there's this idea of an open internet, huge databases, everyone's names, all this stuff available, right? I think we should go in the opposite direction. I think we should go back to being, to having separate things, private things, more exclusivity on the internet, because otherwise, I just don't think it will continue appealing to people. I don't think being part of, At least in a transitional period, maybe after people are more used to it, we can go to something bigger, more open. But I think for now, I mean, for instance, Facebook's initial popularity rush in an America dominated by MySpace was in part due to the age and educational level limits, right? So I think if we had more websites, more social networking or whatever, or companies that were limited and exclusive and invite only, whatever, and everyone could be part of a few different things that they were interested in, I think that would appeal more to internet users. So as opposed to an open, transparent database. And you know, this begs the question too about privacy, where I know I was talking to someone, they were saying if everyone has their lives on display, employers can no longer discriminate based on a Facebook photo and so on. Everyone will just have to be upfront and essentially merge all the facets of themselves in their lives. Well, I don't think this ideology of merging all these parts of yourselves and having your life be available and open and having people be able to see all these aspects makes sense with the global perspective and all the people across it, like throughout the world who aren't online, with all the people in America who are offline, and just the fact that it is really difficult to make all these different parts of yourself, your place self, your work self, your home self, be this one cohesive thing. It doesn't really make sense with how we function. And finally, okay, here's how, except through, I think we can make the internet still appealing through financial gain. So just simply, basically making the internet profitable, we can always appeal to the basic desire for money, right? Like that's always going to be there. If the internet's profitable, if internet websites are profitable, that's always going to be there. That's going to keep people coming back. And then, as Joey was talking about, simplicity and appealing to necessity. So if people have to buy clothes, if people have to buy food, if we can make the internet something that functions for day-to-day life for everyone, if we can make, you know, shelter these basic human needs fulfillable more easily than in, you know, quote-unquote real life through the internet, that will obviously keep people coming back to the internet. simply because it's necessary, right? And obviously the point of keeping users on the internet, first of all, because we all are very invested, we like it, you know, whatever. But also, more importantly, we can use it for significant global change. So if we keep global narratives flowing, if we keep using case studies and keep creating content, if we keep allowing ourselves to have a bigger worldview, to have a bigger scope and perspective because of the internet, you know, that goes beyond human instinct. That goes beyond fulfilling the desire for food or sex or whatever. That's about, you know, having a global awareness and understanding our perspective, understanding where we are in the world. And also, as I've tried to do on Abby's Road, is, you know, again, separately from human instinct, taking another step where we make resources available for people who don't have those resources. So whatever that is, if it's teens in a state where they don't have access to a certain type of education, then we can make that available. And I think that's what's important about the internet, is not just keeping it popular, but using that popularity to give people resources, to make them understand their perspective in the world, and to create a stimulating creative environment for more creation and even more progression in those directions. So that's my piece. I'm sorry, that was so long.
It was,
oh,
it just felt
God.
Longer than you thought it was. Ugh.
So I've been texting with Michael, and he's not in front of a computer.
Michael can't get the computer. That's
controversial
right.
Enough for us to have a really good discussion afterwards.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah, you kind of touched some
that's
nerves.
Did
yeah.
I? Were people saying
yeah.
stuff?
Yeah, no, they liked it. They, no, they a lot like of people it. Thought it was good,
they
but
like it.
I think there's a lot
and
of questions.
It's a good sort of, you know.
There you go, Daniel. That's perfect.
On the ground, sort of down to earth, political and controversial view.
Okay.
So we can a panel discussion right now. We're ready. We got all the cameras set up.
Really? Okay, good. Okay. I thought it was like 40
minutes. Joe, it looks like you want to say something.
I skipped over the most important part, but that's okay.
What's the most important part?
Well, no, I mean, it's fine. Go ahead.
No, I think you made like really excellent points. I always believe like knowledge is power, and so people like can't consume enough data and mm-hmm. enough like information. But there is like a turning point right now that we're facing where I think a lot of people, they see technology everywhere on, you know, you can check it on your iPhone everywhere. And it's about limiting ourselves to technology. Now, I'm really progressive in thinking that, like, technology needs to be, you know, everywhere. And I think it only, a lot of the stuff that we do, you know, is always for a benefit, is always for a positive. Like, you know, if you think about it, like, 10 years ago, we couldn't have shared, you know, pictures, like, this fast with each other. And think of all the cultural, I love that you thought a lot about like the cultural changes that it's made, like the mm-hmm. anthropology of like what is going on the internet right now. And it's a really interesting topic. I think that was a really great speech.
I actually, I don't know if this is the time, if we're just going to jump right into
yeah,
the panel discussion.
Just jump right into the panel. Yeah.
I'd love to do that. And I if you don't mind, I'd like to start it off with a quick question stemming from my what turned out to be totally a speech. But for you,
yeah.
Joey, because we were actually talking about another day, not online, we were talking about the idea of what you just mentioned about how you were saying people can't have enough content. The more data, the better. We need to be all connected. We need to be in this fabric of the web. A lot of you use that term, fabric of the web, really, really interconnected. My question for, I guess, actually all of you is, just basically, do you think we can? Do you think humans have the ability to process that much? Because, you know, as I was talking about, I feel like for some people, it's utterly overwhelming. And maybe that's generational. Maybe it will come with
time.
There
is that information overload, but I think we are reaching a point in like an evolutionary kind of period where we're fundamentally thinking about how we are becoming more one on the internet, like how we mm-hmm. are more similar. And then once like a lot of the third world countries start getting online, then we really see, you know, how we are like very connected. And that's what I'm really excited about. Like how, you know, I think Brian was like talking about like how trends are spreading faster than ever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like information is being shared. And I think it's always good.
Do you think we can?
Yeah, I think we can. Definitely. It's becoming, you know, the world is definitely becoming more of a flat place.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and I really believe that there's like another like world on top of ours, and that's data. And we were kind of talking about this yesterday with like, you know, we were talking about a lot about augmented reality. And so you know, we are at the point now where we can actually use augmented reality apps like on your iPhone or, you know, and see like the data that's, you know, micro targeted onto like a place, or, you know, if we go into a restaurant, then you open up a menu and be able to see like friend recommendations. And, you know, it does get Minority Report. It does get like pretty crazy, but that's kind of like what I'm really excited for. I think it's only helping us. And,
Abby, if people want to ask questions on Twitter, they can use the tag hashtag #TwitSpecials. Well, I just have a few questions that people could ask. So whenever you want to use those, I'm using the hashtag #TwitSpecials.
I have a few just quick comments, and I wanted to talk about sort of the fact that this overload and what we're seeing and observing within our circle is I mean, we've probably very, you're very well aware of the fact that we do live in a bubble, especially in the Valley, and that, you know, we do know personally many people in our circles that are overwhelmed, that have, you know, iPads, iPhones, MacBooks, every single device known to man, and need to be checking 30 different accounts at every given moment. But, you know, one of I feel privileged and honored to have had the chance to see, you know, entrepreneurs and connected people, quote unquote, all around the world. And I've seen that with people adopting technologies after the fact, they've been able to use not peer pressure, but personal choice to make technology enhance their personal lives. And so I think at the end of the day, we do have that choice. It's just within our bubble, and with what we've seen, we know that people feel pressured to be overwhelmed and to be tapped in at any given moment. Like, I know a lot of people in my circle that are always checking, and for me, one of the rules that I have whenever I go out for dinner is I turn my phone to silent, and I actually put it in my pocket and just ignore it for the entire dinner, just so I can give my full attention to the person that I'm talking to. Because at the end of the day, being in person and interacting in that way is just, you know, paramount to how we can progress as an intelligent, progressive society. And the second quick point is that, you know, being social at the end of the day is also part of a human instinct, that we do want to be social, we want to be connected, and we want to share. It's just the internet augments that in a really, really rapid, you know, quick pace that, you know, a lot of people haven't been able to handle.
Right. I mean, I think moving online is something that we need. I mean, I've been like tweeting Daniel Brew for like 3 years, and when I met him in person, I never realized, you know, how cute he is.
You had to go there.
I do think we need to step back from the world, because it's from the web, because in some ways, in technology in general, in some ways it's making us less emotional. We're going towards text.
Never.
We're going towards text instead of actually interacting. We're going through, you know, email instead of actually writing a letter. I mean, I write letters because they're emotional, because you're spending your time and spending your, you know, you're actually writing the letter yourself. You know, it's not just a bunch of 26 characters that are in this font that someone, you know, wrote a million years ago. But yes, I think it's making us less emotional and more into wanting to consume data instead of consuming emotions from other people.
But is that a perspective that you have as being raised knowing about letters? I mean, is that something that generationally, when kids are raised knowing an email, is that going to have all the emotion that a letter could hold for someone in our generation?
Yeah, absolutely not. I mean, an email is just text. And a letter is something that you know, I don't know how people are going to, the people who don't spend time like knowing, you know, letters, knowing like meeting in person, how that would affect how they perceive in society in general and emotions. I don't think it's a good thing. Does anyone like know what, want to predict what kind of effect that would have?
Well, I think before we go into that, I mean, we're in a bubble right now. Like Brian mentioned, we're in this bubble, and we've been for these last couple of years, and it's not something where you can jump out of the bubble. There's a door, and it seems like it's locked. And there's sites like Facebook which have the key to that lock, but they're not opening that lock. And so that's where we are right now in terms of the state of kind of the internet, where we are kind of all trapped. And, you know, everyone says that the internet is so open, you can create your own website and stuff like that. But you know, it's really controlled by the ISPs, the hosting providers. I mean, we really are, you know, trapped. And it's hard to kind of get out of this, you know, this vault when you don't have the keys and the big, you know, the big brother here, you know, which is Facebook and the ISPs, you know, they have the keys.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just say, you know, IRL. You know, IRL is super important. I think it's our generation that's responsible. I think we hold the key, being so empowered and being the generation of innovators, that we have these tools available to us to make such significant change. that it's in our hands to also prove to further generations that being in person and in real life and focusing on what Malcolm Gladwell calls strong ties over weak ties is that we have to focus that – we have to understand and be aware of the fact that we have two predominant emerging types of relationships right now that have been sort of clouding over – just sort of overwhelming what we've been seeing as our social graphs is strong ties and weak ties, right? So we have friends that are our followers or that we follow and that are our friends on Facebook. And these are weak ties. And what's happened with what we have available to us through these social networks is that we're taking weak ties and placing them above strong ties. And at the end of the day, if we look at the core of our networks and we look at the people that we frequently interact with the most on Twitter and on Facebook, we notice that these groups are much smaller than they actually originally seem. And I think that we need to focus on the fact that building strong ties is one of the things that we can truly show the power of how we can use the internet to build relationships and at the same time focus on how being in real life and interacting with one another can also bring light to how those benefits can help us.
I think there's a lot of research studies done on the core social, you know, pool that you have. You do only share a lot of the information with like three or six people, like, you know, like your family and your really close friends. So yeah, Facebook is definitely
becoming... Or Cortex can make it so you can share it to 30,000 people in 1 second.
Yes. Or it's just going to go through like your retina and your brain. Yeah. And then you could just tweet iPhone, everything that you're thinking about. I can't wait. No, I think you still have the core group of friends that you're with. And Facebook is definitely becoming more of like an acquaintance book because you're just adding people that are just, you know... But I think it's really important to... differentiate like those pools. Like you could draw circles and you can draw lines between fans and then people that are just around you or people that are indirectly around you. So if you want to go.
Sorry to move the mic. And you know, to talk about that, I think we've passed the point where we could have got out of the bubble. I think it's really just too late now. We've crossed the point where we can jump out of the state where the internet is our lives. And to go to Joey's point where, you know, Facebook is more of like an acquaintance book, how many people do you actually know that you've added on your Facebook? And, you know, it's really like I have over 2,000 friends. And I'm not saying to brag about this, but to say that, you know, I only know maybe, you know, 200 or 300 of those people. And it's gotten to, well, I go to a pretty big school. But, I mean, it's gotten to a point where we're using these social networks, you know, really quite what word am I looking here? We're really using them to be social, and it's gone to a point where it's really just too late to stop because it's on a roller coaster.
I think it's a little bit of sorry, we're sharing mic. I think it's a little bit of a different type of social. I notice a lot of the younger generation. They definitely are social, a lot more social, but in a different way. So, Abby, like you're talking about, you know, maybe not face-to-face time, but then I notice when I meet a lot of people, like a lot of the developers and designers, they like to talk a lot, you know, through email, but they won't say anything in person, you know. So it's like it's just a different type of social. And I think it's not necessarily a bad thing. Obviously, it's evolving, but...
And I know one of the points you were making that was backing that up, too, is the fact that ultimately, we're moving towards something where it ties it to location and it ties it to the physical world. So you can be having this really great online experience and ultimately connect it completely to your real life and to your social life, and it can become one and the same. And then that doesn't even, you know, deal with those weak or strong connections because it becomes the same thing, and it allows you to have much more fluidity in both ways.
Go ahead. No, I was saying once we get to that micro level, like the GPS, like where you can actually tag something within a room, you know, because you imagine like right now GPS, you know, it'll probably say that we're at the Twit Cottage, but like, you know, actually sitting in this room where you can actually pass like all the paths that you make throughout the day and see like when you cross paths with certain people, then I think it becomes really interesting.
Well, we have to look at what's really behind like us being wanting to be more open, and if we can slow that down or stop it at all, by any chance. And what's really behind it is a thirst for knowledge, as you said. And we want to know what people want, people like. We want to know, like Blippi, we want to know what people are buying. We want to know what people are thinking. And because of that, I don't know if we can move backwards because people are because people want that and because of the benefits they have for us. I mean, I've been able to find a lot of amazing information from people who are, you know, weak ties, a weak, whatever.
Weak ties.
Weak ties, mm-hmm. Right. And you know, we, you know, strong ties do give me more information on a regular basis, but weak ties also do as give me information in general. So because we want this information, because the chance, there's this chance that the weak ties can give us information, that is important, and I don't think we might be able to move back from being experiencing open already. I don't think we can move back that quickly or at all.
And to compliment on he posted it on Twitter. To compliment on what he said with Blippi is one of these really controversial services I think it's a great service, and there's a couple reasons why I think it's a great service is because I think about half the apps that I found on my iPhone are because my friends purchased them, and because of this, my network of quote unquote friends purchased these apps or, you know, got these apps, I feel like maybe, you know, that's another step of a recommendation to get this application. And I feel like services like Blippi, although I don't share my credit card, I share almost everything else but my credit card, because I think there's a fine line between sharing your credit card purchases and purchases that you do on iTunes and Amazon. I mean, I think it's a useful service, but, you know, it's definitely a very interesting and controversial service, and this is exactly where we are in 2010 in the state of the internet. We have services like Blippi and Swipely, which you share private information that 5 years ago you would have never shared. People are adding their addresses and their phone numbers and all this kind of stuff to Facebook, and it's gotten to a point where it's really not safe.
Yeah, it's amazing. I really think about the trust aspect of it, and, you know, sometimes just like the design of the actual website of, you know, Blippi or, you know, a lot of the services where you do share your credit card information, if it's just well designed, you like trust the service more. Maybe you shouldn't, but it's a way that, you know, just because, like, you know, we go into the example of mint.com, you know, how can people share their credit card information, right? And it's, mm-hmm. you know, just very little things like showing the lock or showing that people are kind of used to, and they like that, you know, trust aspect. And that's why it's so important with the company. And, you know, with Blippi, they did have that controversy that did, you know, sacrifice a little bit. But yeah. I think it's still pretty.
We're a very visual generation. And me also being a designer as well, I realize that when we do create things, just simple things, especially even in college as well, just by making my report look a little prettier, you know, things has made a little bit of a mm-hmm. difference. But I mean, at the end of the day, I do want to look at, you know, just the quintessential healthy online lifestyle, like our mothers used to say, or still say, because we're still very young, you know, everything in moderation, right? We can, you know, obviously share things on Blippi. We can buy things off of iTunes. We can tweet all we want and share all we want on Facebook. But at the end of the day, if we can create this balance, if we can create something that's harmonizing enough for us to be able to live our everyday lives without it being an interruption or something that's overwhelming, I think we'll be fine, right? And so that's one of the things that people have to realize. And we try to create this, you know, polarizing perspectives that sort of prove, you know, mm-hmm. what's better, what's mm-hmm. worse, what's this true. And that, you know, there are people who absolutely do not like Blippi or people who do love it, and so there's obviously a choice there. If you like it, you can use it. If you don't like it, you don't have to use it, right? And so these types of choices at the end of the day, if we know how to use them in moderation, we'll be fine.
And I want to back up too, because I was gonna say this earlier, but the way we're talking about this, even it's honestly, it's very much in that bubble. We all are talking about it as this choice or, you know, we can't come back from it. We have Facebook. We have all this stuff online. It's there. It's happening. But I do, again, you know, like I was talking about, we have to have this global perspective too, and even a national perspective, where we realize there are people who have none of that. You know, they have no way of processing even what this means or what this is. They have no information about how to be online or what's being online. And what I want to ask about is the question of privilege, because ultimately we're getting this intense, basically online privilege. We're getting these connections, and we are part of this fabric of the web, and so many people aren't. And it's basically putting them at a disadvantage. You know, as entrepreneurs, like, you guys are emailing all these people, you're following them on Twitter, you're getting, you know, venture capital, whatever. And it's like, there's kids, even in America, who aren't necessarily, they just don't have that. And how do we deal with that privilege? It's like, yeah, we've always had, you know, money privilege or educational privilege, but we're adding this layer in our generation, a huge layer of internet privilege and information privilege. We're essentially getting privilege by the data we have access to and by the data we're providing about ourselves. So how do we deal with that?
I think as technology becomes more affordable and it is as it becomes more affordable, we'll be able to get that privilege, because I know that we all have this privilege that the web being connected and being using technology makes our lives richer, and that's what it really does as a fundamental. And I think, you know, now 10, 15 years ago, some libraries didn't even have computers in them. Now so many do, and I think I don't think it's going to be a huge problem in the future going forward, being information privileged, because, you know, we have the law that, you know, we have how fast technology expands. We know how fast technology expands, and I think access to technology will expand at the same rate, if not faster.
Yeah, we have to look at, like, where where it's definitely heading, you know, in the next few years. And I think being tech nerds, I think we're, like, already, like, you know, a couple of years ahead of being in the mainstream audience. Because, you know, like, we were on, you know, Twitter and, like, all these services, like, you know, when it maybe first came out. And then it became, you know, kind of mainstream this year. So we got to look at, like, where it's going. And I definitely agree with, you know, being a lot more affordable to get it where, you know, in places where, you know, people... And even in the United States, like, they don't have, you know, the fastest internet connection. But I think we're getting
there. I think if you're talking about affordable, I mean, I think DSL Extreme is still one of your sponsors. $15 a month, you can get internet. And I think I think that's a pretty reasonable price if you want to get internet access. And to say
they
that it's
pay
not
you to
a,
say that, did they?
What?
They didn't pay you.
They may pay Leo, but they don't pay
me. Affordable guys.
Yeah.
Free printer.
But realistically, I mean, this really is, it's gotten to a point where it is affordable for most Americans.
Yeah, that's true.
But there is definitely a part that don't have internet access. And Google, with their Google Fiber network, they're investing millions, if not almost $1 billion, into getting high-speed internet to cities. I mean, people even name their cities Google Kansas. You know, Topeka, Kansas, named their city Google Kansas just to try to
fiber.
Get this fiber internet. And I think, you know, saying that it's what?
We have to reuse that dark fiber from the 80s.
Yeah. But, you know, to be perfectly honest, I mean, it really is affordable these days. Sites like, you know, Facebook, free. Twitter, free. Internet, you can get $15 a month or go to the library, free. Yeah. I mean, it's gotten to a point where it is accessible, it is affordable, and anyone can go and access it.
And that's how billionaires are born, right?
Exactly.
Making things that are used to be accessible to only the few, to the many, right? And there's one really fascinating point that I like to normally make, which is about how information and privacy and the sort of this access to technology that we've been talking about is completely and very much cyclical. We see, you know, with what we've experienced in the last, you know, year or 2 years, actually year, yeah, with Facebook's rise, is that we've always wanted more and more information and having it now and in real time, and we want, you know, all these new updates and information right delivered to our face through push notifications. But then we're also seeing right now this move, and I'm not sure if you guys have noticed this, with how there are more services being created right now about filtering information and making it more of
accessible
and more of the personalized and aggregation model. And of course, you know, we're starting to see this movement sort of filter through into very mainstream services such as Dig and such as Facebook. And so the new Dig, for example, has a feature that's been prominently discussed called My News. And what it is essentially an aggregated feed based on what your social signals are starting to create. And of course, the well-beaten horse of the Flipboard topic, and especially sort of seeing how these filtration technologies are now being a key part of how we're trying to consume information. I think we're seeing, again, the cyclical movement of, okay, we wanted more, we got a lot more, now it's starting to go back down. We're starting to see information that's less frequent but more personalized. And of course, there's a bunch of services, for example, that I like to use quite a bit, and one for Twitter, it's called the Cadmus. The CADMUS.com. And what they do is essentially what Twitter's homepage should be, which is a Twitter feed sorted by relevance and not just timestamp. And these types of things are super relevant, and I'm starting to see that in that downward cycle of information flow.
Well, I think what the fundamental thing those servers are doing is filtering out noise so we have richer content that remains.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's true, though, too, just to reemphasize that it is cyclical, because there have, I mean, initially even with really basic things, I remember it was like before Google, I feel like there was that push for more information.
Information overload.
And then we scale back. We look for filters. And then again, back, you know, in a, like you were saying, just to bring it back historically, that has been a very continuous cycle, although it is always moving further towards more information. So before, the first kind of time we went through that cycle, there was less information, and then we filtered it, and then we got more information, but it is still moving forward in general towards more and more
information. I'm curious, in this room, like, do you feel like you have more information overload, like on a spectrum, like if mm-hmm. you have more information overload, or do you feel like you find yourself like wanting more information?
I think for that's me, it's not more of information overload. It's there's not enough hours in the day to read all the information yeah. or
that's,
to go
that's
through.
That's not part of the real life limits that we have, Daniel.
But I mean, yeah, I think that it's gotten to a point where there is information overload. I mean, there's, you know, millions of hours of information held on sites like Wikipedia and WikiHow and all these different sites it's gotten way too much. And all I want is a simple answer. And when I search for Google, you know, I get millions of results. And when all I want is a simple answer, and this is where the information overload is actually happening, is where simplicity, Mr. Joey,
yes. mm-hmm.
who works at Google, you know, this is where the simplicity is key. And that's why services, you know, like Wikipedia show up in the very top results, is because in the first, you know, sentence of that preview of what's going on, you see and you already get your answer. And I think that's where the information overload is happening, is there's way too much under that. That's sometimes really unnecessary.
This is a really great sort of mini segue into sort of addressing a predominant topic in the chat right now, which is just about education and just about how our generation is valuing that. And we're seeing talk about how, okay, yeah, if we have access to any piece of information we want on the web, we can instantly search it on Google and we can access it. And we don't actually absorb it or learn it. And I think one of the very, very important things that academia is still very valuable, I think, in the future and being able to preserve is this notion of learning and actually absorbing this information. And so when we actually receive information, it's a lot different than actually absorbing it. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing this all everywhere, you know. And I think at the end of the day, we need to be able to understand and be cognizant as a generation, and for our children and our children's children and our children's children's children, you know what I mean, is that we need to start to learn and continue to learn and to absorb what we're trying to bring into our conversation and our discourse, especially in academia. And everybody's sort of saying academia is slow, they're not agile enough, they're not bringing social media and marketing into the space. You know what? I think that's actually a good thing, in that we're able to learn in the traditional sense, that we're able to absorb and have enough knowledge to be able to quote some of the greatest minds of the world and in our history, and being able to learn from our history and finally be able to apply those things into what we're seeing right now. If we lose that, we lose a lot, and I don't want to lose that for this generation.
It's even gotten to a point where schools are giving students iPads and all their books are being, you know, on the iPad now. And, you know,
I think it's a good thing, though, because
yeah, I agree, it's a good thing.
You
but
know,
at the
you
same
used to
time,
have a heavy backpack and you used to have to like carry all your books and everything, and I think it's helping actually a lot of
sure,
be
I think,
it, on the same page.
But at the same time, yeah, at the same time, you know, I'm just saying the using the iPad is just one example of schools. I mean, 10, 15 years ago, schools didn't have computers. Schools relied on textbooks and dictionaries and things like that. And I feel like 10, 15 years ago, what you learned at school is actually much more powerful and much more engaging than what we learn today, because now we have these things called smart boards, you know, which are hooked up to our to the teacher's computers. You can draw and do all this. I mean, it's cool technology, but do we really need it is the actual thing?
I beg to differ with that, because I feel like, and we did mention this, I know we did an episode of, what was it, Teens in Tech yesterday?
Yeah, the Teens in Tech podcast.
And this came up a little bit about the idea of the reluctance for change. And I know, you know, I don't want to throw that out there at you, but I do think that we do have tendencies to be like, oh, okay, back then, like, we could understand that, we could process that, that was a good way to present information. But people always say that, you know, rotary phone to not rotary phone, like, all these things. I feel like each time, everyone's like, well, it's easier. And for me, at least, I've seen with my little brother how even in a span of 2 years, these just basically new groups of kids that are growing up with that can process that information. So it's true that, yeah, maybe for us, we can't. You know, maybe...
We're old.
Honestly,
we'll
getting to
this
point.
Never know until the generation that grew up with the iPhone in their cribs.
Well, but we have seen it happen before. Yes, right. Though it has not been with these same technologies, we have seen it happen. With
the problem is we're taking all of this way too much for granted. We feel entitled. Exactly. Yeah. We feel like we should have access to Facebook. We should have access to a cell phone or, you know, an iPhone. I mean,
Do you remember the commentary from Twitter's planned downtime? I mean, like, this was just yesterday, right? I mean, everybody was, like, freaking out. Right?
Yeah. It's really,
who cares? You never even had this in the first place.
Yeah.
Go outside and breathe some fresh air, you know?
And to reply to you, Abby, is I'm not saying it's a bad thing. Like, I'm all for, like, technology at schools because this is what I tried to do for the last 4 years.
Yeah.
In high school. But at the same time, like, you have to, like, think back and be like, 20 years ago when schools didn't have all of this, how did they go through it? Like, and think 100 years ago and, you know, how did schools do it? Like, how did they survive without all this technology? And nowadays it seems like people can't. I mean, like Brian just mentioned, Twitter goes down, people literally freak out. Imagine if Facebook went down. I mean, the whole world would basically explode.
Yeah. And just quickly, for the sake of clarity, I'm going to throw out there, we do want to differentiate between social information and information, right?
Yeah.
So we do want to keep the line between, say, Twitter going down and not having constant updates on your friends versus using something like Wikipedia in schools, et cetera. So just throwing that distinction out there.
I think one of the sexy things as well in the current young entrepreneur space is, you know, dropping out of college and how college isn't really the important thing. And you've seen, you know, people who are like that, you know, you don't need it, you know, blah, 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 blah. As someone who finished, you know, one of the most valuable things that I learned from college was actually learning how to learn and then learning what you don't know. And I felt significantly more stupid when I left college because I realized just how much I didn't know. And I think it's like boot camp. You realize what you're capable of learning when you go through college. And these are the types of things. These are just very traditional, hardcore lessons that you have to just learn. It's just part of that lifestyle. That's part of us growing up. At this point in time, absolutely. And of course, we'll never know. Like, I wish I had a crystal ball to see into the future generations and how they somehow manage to cope with all of this. But right now, what we see is I really do want to make the very focused point that when we know what we don't know and when we know what we need to learn and we realize what's out there and the possibilities, and that's one of the other points that I actually left out of my presentation, which is we have the ability to learn so much to the point where we realize what is possible and then we also realize what is impossible, but then understanding that the limits have changed. And these are the types of things that the internet has enabled us to do, and that is to realize that there are no limits in certain spaces and that we can take these limits and fly with it. And we've seen a lot of services where people have always went, okay, it wasn't the right time and place. You know, the tubes weren't ready. They weren't wide enough. People didn't realize that they actually needed something like this. And that's how we realize with our audacity and what we can understand with what we are capable of and what we know what we don't know, that we can move it ahead.
Right. One of the things that's the problem with this current technology is that we have kind of a tunnel vision as to what we focus on. Because there's four areas of knowledge or lack thereof. There's things we know, there's things we don't know we know, there's things we know we don't know, and there's things we don't know we don't know. Well, I don't know. College does teach you, like, with the things you don't know. It opens your vision to, you know, not just like if you're doing engineering. There's more things in engineering that we have to open our minds about. And opening our minds about things is the one thing that, you know, it's a recurring theme in our discussion. And, you know, the tunnel vision is something that we don't want to promote. And
Well, let's take a step back. We have five of, you know, the future entrepreneurs in this room. Abby
Except
is going
me,
to college.
But, yeah.
Brian has already finished college. Mark is going to college. Joey is in college, and I'm going to college. I mean, so for
so
this
you
whole
trust us,
yeah. But you know, I think it's overrated saying that. For the longest time, I thought that I didn't need school. That, you know, I was in Silicon Valley. I was having the best time of my life, like working at startups. But at the same time, you know, knowing that in the back of my mind, I always knew that maybe I do actually need to go to college, not just for the experience, but for knowing that I accomplished this thing where I thought I didn't need it. And I think, you know, going into college, you know, in 3 weeks, I'm actually really excited. And
there's
some
pretty good looking girls there too.
you know, going into college in the next 3 weeks, I'm very excited because I get to pick my own schedule. I get to pick the classes that I want. It's really in my control, and I can, you know, learn what I want to learn. And that's, I think, the biggest thing about college, and what people are overlooking in terms of college and school in general, is you're controlling your future. And if you don't like something, if you don't like the math class you're taking, take a different math class. Or if you don't like the teacher that you have, you can switch. I mean, it's really that easy with college. And I think the opportunity to go to college, in all, you know, the three of us that are going into college, you know, in the next couple of weeks, and, you know, Brian's already finished. Joey is in his last year.
Yeah,
last
doing year. A graduate program.
Yeah.
So I think it's really important to, yeah, mix your passions, you know, because it definitely really helped me, like, get into Google with doing computer science to know the technical back end, but also doing, like, the digital media and the creative stuff that I really love. So I think, it, like, what makes you unique is, like, really what the classes that you take and kind of, like, merge together. So it's...
Well, on the topic of sort of remedies of this sort of, our generation, how we can just, you know, disconnect for a little bit and actually go back to our roots and really build our foundations is also, I just wanted to quickly advocate about travel and the ability to go out there and just see what's available. And I think I heard this stat somewhere, and I don't quote me on it, but about, I believe, half of the congressmen in the U.S. don't have passports. And I mean, again, like, it just, you hear about these things and you just shake your head. And what I also realized being in college and actually having the ability to go on exchange, I spent 6 months in Southeast Asia and just obviously not studying a lot and actually traveling more of the time, was the ability sort of just, again, you learn so much more through seeing and doing and really immersing yourself in another culture. And I know, Abby, you went to France as well and you went on exchange there. And you realize once you just come back just how some of the topics that are being just argued about just seem so mundane and so tiny and kind of a joke compared to the types of things that you see around the world and the types of issues that need to be addressed. And once that perspective has been enlarged, and Daniel, I highly encourage you to go on an exchange when you do go to college, because these are the types of things that are invaluable experiences. There's no other time in your life where you'll just be able to jump out of, just leave and go to a random country and meet people that you've never met before that are from all over the world, and to have these people to ping when you want a different perspective. And for me, I have friends in almost every single major country in the world that if I now have something that I need to ask about, it's to them. They're on the ground. They know what's going on. For example, in Honduras, you know, they just emerged out of a military coup. Now, of course, the press had a lot to say about it from our end, but, you know, having conversations with them locally, I realized, you know, just exactly what happened. And it all actually sounded like a play fight in, like, the sandbox in the playground when you were in elementary school. Like, it just seemed like that when I was able to actually see it and hear from the locals who were actually there when it was happening. So these types of things, these types of perspectives are so valuable.
Mm. I think this all goes back to the bubble, and I think, especially in I would say in the Valley, we are in a bubble. And I personally love traveling. You know, in November, I got the chance to go to Rome to speak at a conference. And even there, I basically went to Rome for 1 week, and I didn't really use my laptop. I didn't really touch technology. And I experienced a city that I've never been to, and I experienced the culture. And I looked at how different it really is to where we are. I mean, the type of things that I experienced there, like going and seeing the Colosseum and things like that, like, it's surreal. And it really is. And I think that's the whole notion of us being in a bubble, is that I think in 20 years, we're not going to be able to experience these kind of things, because we're going to be so, you know, oh, I need to check my email, I need to check Facebook, Twitter. Like, you're not going to be able to experience the world that we have around us.
Mm. And I mean, I think ultimately it does come a lot to the questions of, will technology make our world bigger? Will it make our world smaller? Will, that's what I was doing. Thank you. my dad's doing little gestures, but that's what it comes down to. You know, it's like, what will this mean for our future? How many people will be logged in? How many people will be online? Will it connect us, or will it separate us? Will it put us into these bubbles, or will it break us out of our bubbles, of our municipality, of our state? And I'm going to quickly, we do have to wrap up. So maybe if everyone, I don't know, it looks like people have more things to say, but unfortunately, I think we are just going to have to wrap it up here.
The guys in the chat room are great, by the way, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
The comments have been very, you know, educational and valuable.
Yeah. So, you know, again, so Thank you guys so much. I think it is, all of these are important questions. We can't predict this stuff. We're going to see it happen. We're all here watching it play out. And hopefully we'll have more of these kinds of conversations, kind of trying to digest what's going on around us and digest how we're going to process this, how this will affect us, and how we can change the effects that technology will have. Because ultimately, we're the ones dictating, as the technology users, as the technology creators, we're the ones dictating where this is going to go, where this is going to take the world, and where this is going to take us as humans and citizens of the world. So thank you guys so much again. Let's go around, say our names one more time, just to close out. So thank you, Daniel, for being here.
You can find me on Twitter at Daniel Brew.
Joey Permiani, you can find me at JP, JNP.
Thank you, Joey.
I want that hashtag. my name is Mark Bale. I'm Mark Bale on Twitter, B-A-O.
I'm Brian Wong. Thanks a lot for joining us today. And my Twitter handle is Brian_Wong. Thanks, guys.
And I'm Abby Laporte. Thank you guys so much for listening. I know it was long. Hopefully you got something out of it. I'm on Twitter.
Episode 2.
Yeah, seriously.
I'm on Twitter at ABBYLAPORTE. So find us all. Thanks so much. This was your Twit special with 5 young people involved in technology. And have a great day. We'll be right back.